morning and welcome to Atheist Talk on KTNF AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Good morning to all of you joining us locally by radio and streaming online. We appreciate you tuning in. Today is Sunday, April
7th.
Yes. Oh gosh, I forgot to change the date. That's all right. I am your ghostly host, Hertzy Hertz, in studio with the vampirist Maddie Love. And via the spirit phone Skype, we have Dr. Jeb Card. I told you I was going to do puns. I'm sorry. It's not even puns. This is just me being silly. Dr. Jeb Card is an assistant teaching professor in the Department of Anthropology at Miami University. He's the editor of the Archaeology of Hybrid Material Culture and the co-editor of Lost City, Found Pyramid, Understanding Alternative Archaeologies and Pseudoscientific Practices. He has been co-host for the popular podcast Archaeological Fantasies and a repeat guest on the podcast Monster Talk. Jeb is joining us here today to discuss his latest book, Spooky Archaeology.
Not that kind of spooky.
Not that kind of spooky?
Well, maybe.
A little, yeah.
Okay. I was going to say I'm feeling cheated here since I made all those great, you know, spooky things.
No, there's monsters and vampires and Cthulhu in it. It's appropriate.
Yeah. All right. Ah, Cthulhu. All right. Well, this is an open conversation, and we welcome and encourage listener interactions with your phone calls to 952-946-6205, your emails to radio@mnatheist.org, tweet us at Atheist Talk, or check out our Facebook page, Atheist Talk. The phone number is only available when we are live, but you can always email or tweet whether we're live or you're listening to the podcast. Maddie, Dr. Jeb, good morning and welcome to Atheist Talk.
Morning.
Well, good morning, Hertzy. Jeb, I wanted to start by saying thank you so much for this book. I love history. I love learning about how people like long ago interacted with their world and like how similar their day-to-day life was to mine and also how different. So, You know, just a general thank you, really. There's not really a question in that.
Okay. I'll take praise. Thank you.
Considering your job, I would really love to see the similarities with ancient cultures.
And clinical microbiology?
Yes.
You know, we both studied minutia.
Well, yeah, true. You know, I mean, one of the things I love telling my students is things are not as that different from today as you might expect. One of the sites I talked to them about is some work from Peru, from Daniel Curran, who found y'all know what trepanation is? You ever heard of that?
Is that where they make holes in your skull?
Yes. And of course, we have found many examples going over 2,000 years ago of you could call it brain surgery, but really skull surgery to release pressure, to do all sorts of things. Well, there was one site that Dr. Daniel Curran worked on where it was a skull with no signs of healing. There were several, but on this particular skull, and there were numerous holes, like about 20. On this, of various sizes, growing and growing, like, you know, like a ratchet set where they get bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, like the individual sockets for a wrench. I'm probably mixing tool metaphors that I don't really know about. But this was practice. It was medical school. They literally found evidence of someone practicing on a skull at, in essence, a 2,000-year-old South American medical school. So, yeah, not quite microbiology, but
with risks of infection, you know, microbiology was definitely involved. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, trepidation about trepanation. So I guess a good place to start is in conversations is usually with definitions so we can all make sure we're talking about the same things. Like, sure. Archaeology isn't like some weird unknown word to most people, but you're a professional. Can you define what archaeology is for us?
Well, I mean, I think it's both known and unknown. So if you were to go to, we could probably look up a dictionary, but you go to a dictionary or an encyclopedia entry, or if you asked someone who either is in archaeology or who, you know, knows enough about how it's done by professionals, they would say something like, archaeology is the study of the material culture of past people in order to understand their lives, with material culture being the things that we make and modify. One could gloss that a little more easily and say it's going through dead people's trash to spy on them, which is somewhat easier than going through live people's trash to spy on them, depending on your jurisdiction. Now, that's legitimate archaeology in terms of a definition. Like, oh, I look at the leftover remains of that we leave on the landscape, the physical clues, everything from broken bits of pottery and stone tools and fragments to the trade of metals to, how they built this architecture and big pyramids and ritual practices like burials and so on. And it can also expand and include things like one could argue that most people, when they think archaeology, they would include epigraphy, which is reading, you know, ancient hieroglyphs on a wall or an object. While I teach in an archaeology course, for example, I will bring up archaeogenetics, which, you know, getting back to microbiology, is entirely about either mitochondrial or nuclear DNA and what that can tell us about where people are, where they were coming from. You know, there's archaeochemistry. So there's tons of ways. It's not just trash, but material residue that tells us about past societies and peoples. And some even argue studying material culture today falls into archaeology. You know, if you're trying to understand people through the things they make. Now, the reason I say people both know it and don't know it, that's a legitimate take on archaeology. The reality is, though, when most people sort of think of archaeology in a popular sense, they may think of that, but it often involves things that are larger. I mean, the title of the book is Spooky Archaeology, Myth and the Science of the Past. They often think about things that are bigger or less mundane than ourselves. And I don't mean bigger necessarily literally larger, although sometimes that's the case. But things that are more than human. And I think that's actually a place where a lot of professionals fall down when talking to a larger audience. Is they're like, well, this thing is really important and it's, you know, here, but that is not necessarily how people see it. There's, you know, if you look at, you know, name a movie or a game or a television show that talks about archaeology, tell me the chances it doesn't either involve murder or the supernatural or both.
Yeah.
And there's reasons for that. That's not just bad media. There's reasons for that.
Yeah. So when you're talking about like the difference between the major and the mundane, and so are you saying like that when you're studying or when archaeologists are studying things that are that I would maybe as an outsider, as a layperson, would consider mundane, you guys are like looking at going, no, but this explains a lot. Don't you understand?
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, we could look at, you know, so for example, I'll give you an example and then I'll talk about maybe I think why there's a disjunct for a lot of folks. You know, my dissertation research was not on this topic, as my advisor was like, no, you're not doing that. No, it wasn't just that. But I went and worked on the first Spanish settlement in El Salvador, you know, where the majority of people were not Spaniards. You know, this is during the Spanish conquest of Central America. It's a couple of years after the Spanish conquest of what's known as the Aztec Empire, the Triple Alliance. And so this is in Central America. And I studied 45,000 little bits of pottery. But from that, we were able to determine not just, oh, this is where people were doing their cooking. This is where they were doing their, you know, this is where tax tribute was being stored. And, oh, and these people may have come from somewhere else. But even things like, oh, look, the temper, the stuff in this pottery here is slightly different than over here, or the treatment of the surface. And that changes through the stratigraphic column from the bottom of the hole to the top of the hole. And it's probably over two generations, because I also compared this to pottery in Spain and Italy in form, which gave us a tighter chronology. And the fact that it changes is probably due to the fact that it's a second generation of potters and their culture is changing in this colonial context, because they're all, you know, all of a sudden I'm answering social questions, which are important, out of little bits of broken plates that people threw away. You know, that's mundane, but of course we can tease all kinds of stuff out of that, you know, and that's not even using chemical analysis. That's not, you know, looking at genetics. We can tease tons and tons of information out of little bits of clues. And, you know, the CSI comparison is not inapt. The detective comparison is not inapt. But again, if you ask people about archaeology, is that what they talk about? Like, oh, well, yes, I read this thing about these little broken bits of pottery and it was fascinating about social life. No, they either, you know, either it's like, oh, this king's tomb full of gold, or the oldest shipwreck, or and then of course things like, oh, an ancient civilization that's under the water, or aliens, or any of those kinds of things. And I think one of the main reasons for this is if you look around the world, people generally divide time into two basic kinds of time. One kind of time is human time. And it's usually the last couple hundred years where people are like us. You know, my great-great-grandfather or their neighbor made that building downtown, and we can think of other motivations. Once you get beyond that, you have mythic time. You have this just kind of like, oh, it's ancient. And that's where the mythic stuff comes in. And mythic doesn't mean untrue. Mythic means it explains how the world is in big, broad brush strokes. It has a resonance with larger values of our culture. And once you get into that, it's generally bigger than us. And even, the secular folks, do this very much. Do people really just think about the Big Bang in terms of the physics? No, they think about it in terms of beginnings. You know, are dinosaurs just another kind of animal, or plesiosaurs just, another kind? No, they're sea monsters, or they are metaphors for success or failure, or they're cool dragons, or, we do this. The Ice Age is just not one period of climate change. It's like, oh, well, this is different and formational. And we do the same thing. Once it gets beyond our experience, we start to read it in bigger ways that we would not read what happened, down the street half a generation ago. And I think because the job of archaeology, real professional archaeology, is to, in essence, map all of time as human time, like to make it, oh, we learned what these people were like, and they're like us, but a little different.
All right, we're going to actually
have to... Because that's our job, we forget that.
Hey, Jeb, we're going to have to cut you off for just a moment. We're going to run into a commercial break here.
Oh, yes, sure. But please stay with us through the break. We'll return to Atheist Talk with Maddie and Dr. Jeb Card, regarding their ghastly tales of spooky archaeology.
Hi, everybody. This is Paul Metza from the Wall of Power Radio Hour. We have a great show this weekend. The fourth appearance of the great Charlie Pierce. Charlie is a liberal blogger, writes for Esquire.com. You hear him on the Stephanie Miller Show. And when we have him on, we call it Checkpoint Charlie. We talked music, hockey, politics. There's no brighter guy on the scene today than Charlie Pierce. Listen to it Saturday at 6 p.m., Sunday at 4 on AM 950.
I'm Candy Broffel, publisher of the Twin Cities edition of Natural Awakenings magazine and host of Green Tea Conversations, a new show for people who are on a journey to take responsibility for their health and play a more active role in their family's well-being. Join me every Sunday at 10 a.m. as I interview local experts who share the latest in natural holistic approaches in a fun and informative way. So grab a cup of tea and join the conversation as we awaken to natural health. Visit us at naturaltwincities.com.
I'm Richard R.J. Eskow, and this week on The Zero Hour, reviewing the Mueller papers with Ryan Grimm, why Medicare for America is not Medicare for all and not for you, repercussions of Russiagate, and feel-good stories about starving children. All this and more on The Zero Hour, every Sunday night from 9 till midnight on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Hi, my name is Mickey McCabe, and I'm the owner of Cucumbers Restaurant at 75th and Francine Dinah. If you've never been to Cucumbers, it's a buffet-style restaurant with a huge variety of salads, homemade soups, bakery items, and hot entrees that change daily and nightly, plus our always fresh fruit and delicious ice cream. We're open for lunch and dinner, but Sunday brunch is my favorite time at Cucumbers, with scrambled eggs, waffles, French toast, bacon, sausage, baked ham, chicken fajitas, brunch potatoes, warm gooey cinnamon rolls, and many other items to choose from. It's no wonder why Cucumbers has always been a popular Sunday destination. So whether you're looking to skip Mass, someplace to go after Mass, or just great food to maintain your Mass, Cucumbers is the answer to your prayers. Bring in your church bulletin or Minnesota Atheist newsletter and receive a $2 discount off the buffet price. Cucumbers, one heavenly buffet at 75th and France in Edina.
Don't believe in God? Join the club. Humanists, atheists, and freethinkers have joined the American Humanist Association since 1941 to advocate for progressive values and equality for non-theists in America. Located in Washington, D.C., the American Humanist Association lobbies Congress on humanist issues, protects the rights of atheists in the courts, and supports more than 140 local chapters. Visit us at AmericanHumanist.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter to learn how you can join the club today.
Welcome Welcome back to AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're tuned in to Atheist Talk, and I'm your host, Hertzy Hertz, in studio. With me is Maddie Love, and via Skype is the author of Spooky Archaeology, Dr. Jeb Card. Atheist Talk is produced with the funding from Minnesota Atheists and Cucumbers Restaurant in Edina, Minnesota. Please consider visiting our sponsors, and if you do, let them know that you appreciate their support of Atheist Talk. If you'd like to advertise on this program and help keep us on the air, please contact us at radio@mnatheist.org. As for the here and now, if you'd like to get involved in the conversation with Maddie, Dr. Jeb, and I this morning, you can call us at 952-946-6205, email us at radio@mnatheist.org, or tweet us at Atheist Talk. Or you can check out the Facebook page where there is a common thread going on right now that you can look into. So, Maddie, Dr. Jeb Card, welcome back.
Well, thanks, Hertzy. You know, when we went into the break, I cut you off, Jeb. Was there anything you wanted
That's
to finish
right.
from that train of thought?
No, I was about where I was trying to get to. Just okay. this, the fact that that there's a reason why, you know, on the one hand, archaeologists like, well, we're trying to say these things. It's not just aliens. People are like, well, but this thing, you know, maybe why not this? And like, well, we're not going to talk about that. There's a reason why people want to talk about aliens or Atlantis or curses or all of that. Or other things, and this often doesn't go well when you actually talk to real archaeologists about it.
Yeah, and, you know, you were talking about things like being mundane about, you know, how pottery shards can change over time, but I think one of the things that fascinates me about that is it helps humanize those people for me. You know, when I think of, say, the Mayan culture, it's not just like one thing that never changed. It was static. It changed just like our culture changes, maybe not with the same rapidity, but it
right.
still wasn't stagnant like maybe people think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's, you know, and that is, again, that expansion of human time. You know, it's like, oh, these are people like us. They have goods. They have bads. They do cool things. Sometimes they don't do cool things, just like we do. And by looking at them, we learn about ourselves. But that is around the world, and including, for example, even, you know, the Maya, they didn't necessarily see it that way. They had their own kind of ideas about the past. For example, if you go back to the, especially to the early classic, you see it later. The early classic is the sort of the first half of the first millennium CE. You find numerous depictions of a great big shark fighting two hero twins. Now, hero twins are this big kind of, it's found in a lot of American societies, a lot of indigenous American societies, you know, these two heroes that fight various monsters and kind of set the world the way it is. They are part of origin stories. You know, the word myth gets put on there. Although, as I was saying before, doesn't mean it's true or not true. It's just, it has, resonance. And one of the things they're fighting is a giant frigging shark. Well, the thing about that is the front tooth of this shark is portrayed as being very large and dark and shiny. It's actually basically depicted as being the same as jade, which was this really important material, dark and shiny, and jade like marble, like the way we think of marble as of the Romans or the Greeks or whatever, as also being ancient. Now, if I have a big, you know, if I'm saying a really big shark and its teeth are and its teeth are dark and shiny, does this ring a bell? Does this remind you of anything?
No, I'm sorry.
Megalodon.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. Actually,
and we find megalodon teeth in ritual caches as next to modern shark teeth in Mesoamerica, in the Maya region, in the Olmec region. They were finding these friggin' teeth and going, well, there must have been a big, huge shark. And they have a story about the hero twins getting rid of it and putting the world to rights.
Wow. Well, I mean, not that Megalodon has gone extinct or anything. It's still around. That was sarcasm.
About that.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I have a slight healthy fear of shark. I mean, very slight in the healthy part, but fear of Megalodon shark attacks.
See, honestly, I'm down with the Megalodon because, you know, if you're going to get, you know, bitten by a shark, it's like, well, that's just going to happen. Like, just you're done. You know, it's like, oh, it's going to take my leg off, you know, if you're attacked by some other kind of thing, which, of course, shark attacks are incredibly rare. We kill far, far, far more sharks, which we shouldn't. But, you know, if this were to happen, it's like, oh, my God, my femoral artery, like, versus, oh,
I'm inside of a shark
between its teeth. Like, this is just done now. So I don't know. I find Megalodon mildly reassuring as shark attacks might go. Besides, I mean, you're going to get killed by something.
get killed by Megalodon.
It's a kind of awesome way to go.
So the full title of your book, Spooky Archaeology, says The Myth and Science of the Past. What exactly does that mean?
All right. So one of the things that I found, and I guess it's sort of what I was talking about before the break, that a lot of professional archaeologists have been so well trained and they're so versed in doing that humanization of the past that you're talking about, they forget that this is not the primary way that people see things. I mean, I'll just say something. You know, Ancient Aliens, the TV show Ancient Aliens, the concept, not very good. It's not very smart. But that's frankly more representative of how many people, again, cross-culturally see the past as a place of bigness, of myth. So it's like, you know, on the one hand, you have a science of the past. But on the other hand, that is not how often people see it. And bringing that to the attention of archaeologists more than, you know, there's a lot of places in the book where I'm talking to a larger audience, but then I will slip into we. Like, look, we need to understand this. You know, it's written for both audiences. Like, it's got mummies' curses. It's got archaeologists as spies. It's got the origins of Cthulhu, all these sorts of things. But it's also like, here's why people, you know, especially the last chapter of it, here is why people are not listening to you. And the reason why is that you're not even really understanding how people engage with the past, how making what I call extra humans, sort of like people that are not people, is inherent to how people engage with material culture of the past. Our version is Ancient Aliens. We're like, well, did we build this? No. Well, those people didn't build it, because this is where the colonialism and the racism comes in. Well, they're not, you know, good civilized white people in South America. They didn't build it. We didn't build it. Aliens. Well, that's not an unusual idea. In medieval Europe, when ancient stone tools were found, they were considered to be the products of elves. Because, well, we didn't build this, and the Romans didn't build this. We didn't make this, but somebody made it, clearly. And so it's elves that shot things from the woods at you. In the Middle East, it was jinn, and is jinn, and is aliens today, but it's jinn in the Middle East, genies, like, that built this ancient thing. Oh, the pharaoh totally built the pyramids. You is a folk concept you see in some places. He controlled many jinn to do it. In the Maya region, you had Alu Sho, basically very similar to the sort of the elves of Europe. So this, the way that archaeologists approach the past is awesome, and it is a minority perspective.
So we've only got like a minute left, but I wanted to move on. Like, you mentioned in the opening chapter of the book that the book isn't a debunking book, and we don't have much time for the break, but can you explain what you meant by that?
Well, so, I mean, we have done some solid work and go, you know, people are like, oh, well, these relics are actually Roman, or this stone structure in New England is really Celtic. It's like, well, like, no, That's not. This, we have plenty of reasons why this is a colonial thing, or this is an indigenous thing, or this is a hoax. And that work absolutely needs to be done. And I've been involved in that kind of work. But I think in order to understand why those kinds of claims get made, we need to look at the bigger picture. We need to look at sort of where these ideas come from and why they are so popular. And that's more what I'm interested in doing here.
Fantastic. So when we get back, I wanted to talk about a little bit about, have you explained how difficult it is for you to watch maybe some popular science channels in the History Channel? But
I definitely would like to talk about pop culture. We can do that, yeah.
All right. We'll return right after the break with Maddie Love and Dr. Jeb, author of Spooky Archaeology. Please stay with us. I'm Hertzy Hertz, and you're listening to Atheist Talk on KTNF AM 950.
Hi, Gregory Rich, founder and chief at Habitation Furnishing and Design, and now I'd like to invite you to kill your Sunday evenings with me right here on AM 950 with Drink in the Style. It's a one-hour long conversation about interior design, art, architecture, and pretty much anything else, visual and aesthetic, all while enjoying some booze handcrafted by our friends at Gianni's Steakhouse in downtown Wayzata. Can you think of a better way to spend Sunday evenings? Drink in the Style, Sundays, 5 p.m.
Connections Radio Show is all about tapping into our hardwired hunger to connect. We examine meaningful connections to ourselves, our community, and the world around us. By opening the door to innovative insights by a wide variety of interesting guests, we'll make the connections to something bigger than ourselves. Join me, Lori Fitz, your host of Connections Radio Show, and together we'll make the connections. Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Hi, this is Ken Hagland, host of Living Healthy and Aging Well, inviting you to listen to our new show airing on Saturdays from noon to one, where we talk about your health and your life and provide insights to living and aging well. Each week, we provide answers to important questions regarding health care, elder care, end-of-life care, and caregiver support to help you and your loved ones plan for the future and enjoy your highest quality of life today. Please join us every Saturday from noon to one for Living Healthy and Aging Well.
Atheists, secular humanists, and free thinkers, here you are listening to the Minnesota Atheists Talk Radio Show, Atheist Talk. We hope you are enjoying it. If having a frankly atheist perspective on the radio waves appeals to you, please consider making a contribution to our radio fund. Our contract came up for renewal, and we need your help if you want the program to stay on the air. That will make sure that you can continue to have opportunities to hear interesting speakers with non-religious perspectives, and you can call up and ask them questions too. Get the details on our website at minnesotaatheists.org, where you will find buttons to make it easy to make a secure donation through PayPal. Or, if you have a business and would like to reach an intelligent, progressive audience, please contact us through our website. That's minnesotaatheists.org. Or call us at 612-588-7031. If you are interested in us, we are interested in you.
Don't believe in God? Join the club. Humanists, atheists, and freethinkers have joined the American Humanist Association since 1941 to advocate for progressive values and equality for non-theists in America. Located in Washington, D.C., the American Humanist Association lobbies Congress on humanist issues, protects the rights of atheists in the courts, and supports more than 140 local chapters. Visit us at AmericanHumanist.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter to learn how you can join the club today.
With your AM 950 weather, I'm Sam Turnberg. Today we could see showers with a high near 63. Tonight's mostly clear with a low around 43. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high near 65. Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high near 52. And Wednesday, cloudy with a high near 40. Tax day is approaching, and Moe's Tax Service has been working for you, not the IRS, since 1971. Come to Moe's for personal taxes, business taxes, audit representations, and more. They're located in Highland Park in St. Paul. And more information at moestax.com.
Thank you for tuning in to Atheist Talk on AM 950 KTNF. I'm your host, Hertzy Hertz, and we're having what I would classify as a fascinating conversation with Maddie Love and Dr. Jeb Card. If you'd like to get involved in the conversation with Maddie, Dr. Jeb, and I this morning, you can call us at 952-946-6205, email us at radio@mnatheist.org, tweet us at Atheist Talk, or check out the Facebook page, where also the Minnesota Atheist Group also has a link and a comments section. But before we continue the conversation, a little bit more housekeeping to attend to. I want to note our group of dedicated volunteers, like Maddie, and the generous donations of you, our listeners. You help keep Atheist Talk on the air and in podcast form. I'd also like to note our donors of the week, which is the people who were at the Flying Spaghetti Monster last week, which also was me, which was so much fun.
You just thank yourself.
Well, I mean...
I'm just teasing. Go on.
I tossed a few bucks in. But also, it's just the fact it's always great for the Flying Spaghetti Monster because, you know, the show does take a certain amount of money to keep on the air. And it's always great when I hear that it's like, yes, we got another week. Awesome. If you're able to help with a donation, please consider doing so at our Radio Fund page or at our Patreon, where you can get extended interviews at www.patreon.com/atheisttalk. Minnesota Atheist is a 501c3 tax-deductible organization, and we very seriously could not do this show without you, and we deeply appreciate your support. Music for Atheist Talk is by composer and member Michael Davis and is used with permission. Please note all opinions are of the guests and hosts only and do not necessarily reflect those of the Minnesota Atheist Organization. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Maddie and Dr. Jeb Card.
So going into the break, we were chatting about quite a bit. But then off air, we were also talking about Cthulhu. And I feel like the two things that we were talking about kind of go together because Pop.
I actually have a question from online.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes, yes. Great. Joe is asking, what is Dr. Card's favorite movie that is archaeology themed?
Oh, that's a really good question. And it also kind of ties into what you were just leading into because it's not a straight up Lovecraft adaptation, but it's definitely in there. Quatermass and the Pit. There's two versions. It was a big, massive BBC thing in the 1950s, like a miniseries, like a couple of nights thing. And then they made a Hammer version in, I want to say, like 1966 or so. It's actually coming out on Blu-ray, which it's not almost, it's impossible to get for region one. It was made by Hammer in 1966, and it's very good, about an archaeological dig, which turns out is inspired by an actual archaeological dig in London in the 1950s in the city of London, where they accidentally found, during tube excavations, a secret Roman temple in the center of London to the secretive god Mithras. So this inspires this movie where they're digging a tube extension, and they find something in a place called Hobbs Lane. And to get into all of it and spoil it, I just want to put it out there. It involves devils. It involves aliens. It involves the nature of humanity. And it involves archaeology. And it's a classic. I highly recommend it. I guarantee your listeners have probably seen something that's been at least somewhat influenced by it. Quatermass and the Pit, also known as 5 Million Years to Earth, which was the American release title.
I am so looking this up later.
Yeah, it's coming out, I think, in May on Blu-ray for Region 1, so you could get it.
Nice. Well, and to be honest, like, I had never, before picking up this book, because I apparently completely had a brain fart on the Monster Talk episode you guys did, I didn't equate Cthulhu with actual archaeology.
Neither did I, technically, because I knew that H.P. Lovecraft wasn't influenced by Poe, but that was about
And I listened to an entire episode on Monster Talk.
Yeah. See, I at least have the excuse where I didn't have that.
His early work is Poe influence and several other authors. There's quite a few. And I mean, his very first story is literally about, like, well, his first one he publishes, Dagon, is about an island, kind of a prototype of the later Cthulhu story called Cthulhu, where a traveler is on an island that has risen, and there are inhuman carvings on giant sky-flung monoliths and all sorts of things. But a lot of his early stories are not that archaeology. They have elements of archaeology. They have elements of a mythic past. His quote-unquote Dreamland story, quite a few seem to actually be kind of in the past, like the Cats of Ulthar and all of that. But all of that changes in 1923 when he reads a book by one of the pioneering scientific Egyptologists, Margaret Murray of University College London, called The Witch Cult in Western Europe. It's a long story, including involving an unsolved murder, which I went and looked at the original files from Scotland Yard, which was awesome. But she, in 1921, writes a book that basically is the most complete version of what gets known as the old religion idea, the idea that the witch trials of the 16th and 17th century were not people just victimizing their neighbors and, you know, setting them on fire to take their land and whatnot, but was actually an ancient religion that had been demonized and turned into Satanism. And generally, historians and archaeologists do not – there's a lot of interesting archaeology of witchcraft and of magic, but they generally don't support that today. But Lovecraft reads that in 1921, and he absolutely finds it to be cutting-edge anthropology, which quite a few people at the time did. After he reads this by this archaeologist, his stories start to become much more archaeological. They become much less dreamy and more set, like, in actual places with actual dates, with universities, rather than it's a traveler. Now it's like Professor Angel from, you know, Brown University, and it's in this place at this time. It starts to become much more solidified. And in his notes that become the Call of Cthulhu, he literally calls the Cthulhu, what becomes a Cthulhu cult, the witch cult. And he went on and on about it in his letters to friends like Robert E. Howard, the creator of Conan the Barbarian. That is a major archaeological thing. If you think about the story, The Call of Cthulhu, which creates the entire Cthulhu mythos. I mean, there's a reason it's called that. There's a reason why it's a classic story. Never mind that Lovecraft is a giant friggin' racist, and that does, unfortunately, inform parts of that story. But there's a reason this thing is famous, and it's the notes of a dead anthropologist going through his dead archaeologist who's been killed by a cult, spoilers, uncle. and there's another dead archaeologist in there, and it's all about archaeologists and archaeological meeting, a good chunk of it. They find ancient ruins. I mean, this is what the whole thing is about. And that story is written from August 1925 to August 1926, and it is primarily set in early 1925, basically February to April 1925. I went back and looked at every New York Times article about archaeologists written during Lovecraft's adult life. There is a giant spike in stories at that exact time about dead archaeologists, and not just obituaries, but like articles, and also about sunken continents. And the sunken continents is because the New York Times had, which is another part of the story, the New York Times had partnered with a guy, Byron Kuhn de Prorok, who was all about like basically going around. He's kind of like the sort of History Channel guy of the day or Travel Channel going around and, you know, sort of making stuff up in North Africa. But the dead archaeologist part comes from the fact that the biggest archaeology story of the 20th century had just happened. King Tut, Tutankhamun, is discovered, his tomb, in November 1922. And it's pretty much front page news every day, 1923 and into 1924. And it took about a year. And then the media were like, huh, that sells. And so the narrative of how archaeology was covered in the public changed right at the moment that Lovecraft writes this story. There is never another time in his life when the media is most like this. And I think it's a huge influence on him. I think there's a couple of influences. But we know he clipped newspaper clippings and used them as inspiration. So this makes a lot of sense. There's more to it than that. But that's a key argument that I do make in the book, is that Cthulhu is in essence King Tut.
That's just so fascinating how like how pop culture and actual archaeology can, you know, become so intertwined to the point where, like, you know, now almost 100 years later, because it's, yeah, almost 100 years now later, it feels like it's just a myth now, the entire thing. Like,
yeah,
everything,
yeah,
from, oh, yeah, King Tut through Cthulhu. Like, there's no way that I, without like a professional like you explaining it to me, there's no way that I could try to unravel that.
Well, and it's even hard for professionals. I've seen people make certain, I'm not going to get into the specifics, but make arguments about this sort of stuff where they're kind of backtracking, you know, they're sort of, you know, what we call retconning and, you know, in fandom and all that. We're like, oh, well, that's like this. Like, no, that didn't happen yet. You know, like, you've got to really get, you know, just as you, when you dig up potsherds in the ground, you got to be very detailed on your records. It's the same sort of thing. But this, that back and forth with fiction is really important for understanding academics call the cultic milieu. I have some other terms for it. Basically all this kind of stuff, conspiracy theory, paranormal, UFOs, psychic, you know, all this, all that kind of gets together. The back and forth between fiction and these things. There's a friend of mine, Blake Smith from the Monster Talk podcast. He uses the term cryptids, about how so many quote unquote cryptids, mystery animals, get their start with influences from pop culture, from books, and especially movies. That's a big one. Here's one that vast majority of I have yet to meet an archaeologist that knew this. Someone else did figure it out. I just not met that person. I've read their stuff a few years before I did, which annoyed me to no end. The original The Mummy, like the 1932 Mummy, which is pretty much the same plot as the Brendan Fraser one, the 1999 one, and the Rachel Weisz, who's frankly the star of that movie. That is based on an actual story that was uncovered on a papyrus in, I think, 1864, that dates to the 3rd century BCE from Egypt at the time of Greek influence. It is the only Egyptian story about a mummy that resurrects in our world and, like, menaces somebody breaking into tombs as they're trying to steal an ancient book. It's the only thing even remotely like it. And we know that this is almost certainly the – we know this is the basis for the screenwriter, who was an amateur Egyptologist. He is a reporter that covered the Tut excavations. Well, here's the kicker. That's a 3rd century BCE piece of folklore. It's based on a guy who lived 1,000 years before that, who was real. His name was Camwiset. He was the eldest son of Ramses the Great. He would have become king, except he died and his dad was still alive. He was the high priest of the land, and he went around as part of his job, because he was fascinated by this, collecting ancient magical inscriptions and restoring old pyramids and tombs, which I'm pretty sure if you're going in the ground and writing down inscriptions no one has seen and then restoring these sites, that makes him the world's first archaeologist, and he is the inspiration for the story of the mummy. And, like, ask colleagues of mine, like, they don't know this.
That it's fascinating.
Yeah. No, that one blew my mind. I was like, wait a minute. This, and then I found that someone had figured this out in 2006, and I'm like, of course they did.
Yeah, and I was actually going to ask you if there was ever a case where, like, the myths of an ancient civilization, like, you know, what they have about themselves, if they're similar to the myths that, like, modernity has about ancient civilizations. And then I just looked at the clock and realized we have, like, 45 seconds before we're going to break, and that was a pretty complicated question.
Well, maybe we can pick that up to some degree after the break, then.
Definitely. Yeah, I just, you know, when you, as you talk, so this story, like the mummy story, that's like 3,000 years old. Is that, am I understanding that right?
The story is 2,300 years old, but the guy is 3,500 years old. Yeah.
That is so, I find Egypt to be one of those places where, like, it's hard for me to, it does a good job of helping me understand my limited grasp of time on, like, the difference between, like, when the Sphinx was created until, like, the year, you know, zero, essentially. Not that there's a year
zero,
but.
Well, how about after the break we talk about Egypt and we relate it to the Roswell UFO crash?
That sounds out of this world.
Yeah.
Oh. Wow.
We'll return right after the break with Dr. Jeb Card and Maddie Love. Please stay with us. I'm Hertzy Hertz. You're listening to Atheist Talk on KTNF AM 950.
This is New Beginnings, hosted by award-winning broadcaster and speaker Freddie Bell.
Freddie, this generation of the baby boomers, people are living longer, so the baby boomers are taking care of elderly parents.
Let's talk about your health, and specifically, let's talk about Medicare. Our show features the concerns of America's 78 million baby boomers in employment, finance, health and nutrition, and even entertainment.
Catch New Beginnings with Freddie Bell, Saturdays at 11 on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Native Roots Radio is proud to announce we've added an extra hour.
Yeah, Chuske, 1 hour goes by too fast.
That's right, Uncle Curtis.
I'll have extra time to share important information about our sacred animals.
And report national and native news from all over the country and Canada.
This new hour is sponsored by Robbins Kaplan LLP, dedicated to redefining excellence for high-stakes litigation representation in Indian country.
We are awake.
Hi, my name is Mickey McCabe. I'm the owner of Cucumbers Restaurant at 75th and France in Edina. Many who have dined at Cucumbers are of the opinion that our buffet has evolved from an older, more country-style buffet. They look at our 50-foot salad bar and can imagine a smaller ancestor with far fewer choices. An ancestor that didn't offer as many hot selections or have a bakery with fresh-baked muffins and breads. Didn't offer homemade soups and lacked the fresh fruit and ice cream bar that Cucumbers customers have grown to love. But some will say, where are the transitional buffets? In addition, they look at everything that we offer and say that Cucumbers is irreducibly complex. If you were to move just one of our offerings, the entire buffet wouldn't function. Well, I would like to think that Cucumbers was intelligently designed, since I helped design it. But at the same time, it truly is an evolutionary step up the buffet ladder. And as always, if you bring in your atheist newsletter or church bulletin, you will receive a $2 discount off the buffet price. Cucumbers, one heavenly buffet at 75th and France in Edina.
I've never met another atheist.
Sure you have. Non-believers make up 12% of the population.
Then where are they?
You can meet us at book clubs, pub crawls, discussion groups, movie nights, monthly meetings.
Okay, I get it. How am I going to keep track of all this?
Easy. Sign up for Minnesota Atheist Meetup Group and subscribe to AWE.
What's a meetup group?
Meetup is an online networking site that helps people build communities. We have over 700 members with at least two events every week.
And what is AWE?
It stands for Atheist Weekly Email. It comes out every Friday and lists everything that's going on.
How do I sign up?
Go to the Minnesota Atheists website, minnesotaatheists.org. On the left, click on the words Get Awe-Inspired.
And for the meetup?
Look for the red meetup badge on the right. Above it are the words, click here to check out the meetup group.
I'm sold. Minnesota Atheists, Meetup, and AWE. What's that website again?
MinnesotaAtheists.org.
Welcome back to AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're tuned in to Atheist Talk. I'm your host, Hertzy Hertz, here in studio with the wonderful Maddie Love and on Skype with Jeb Card. Dr. Jeb Card, sorry. This is our final segment with Maddie and Dr. Jeb Card. If you're curious about Minnesota Atheists, you can check out the Minnesota Atheist website, which actually the new website should be released.
Today, like if I go on here right now, keep talking.
I'll keep talking. Yeah. You double check. But where you can browse articles, book reviews, peruse the calendar of upcoming events, sign up for the Atheist Weekly email, which will give you links to upcoming events. And we have a ton of activities going around the Twin Cities and outlying suburbs. For example, today we have brunch at Cucumbers, which is my favorite place. Like, that is Cucumbersy. It's my favorite buffet place, honestly. also, Sunday, April 14th, we are doing Dinner with the Board, which is a mouth-watering menu. We are going to be cooking up a storm of Cuban-inspired food, pulled pork, tropical rice, black beans. I think we're doing like a super awesome dessert. I'm so excited. And I'm so excited to cook for all of their guests. Please, if you are able, do come. It's a great chance to help support Minnesota atheists. And you get to have a you can bend the ear of a board member, like myself, or bend sweater vest.
Is your ear really that bendable?
My ears are fairly flexible.
Okay. All right. Go on.
Oh, yes. But if you enjoy the show and all that Minnesota Atheists has to offer, do please consider becoming a Minnesota Atheist while you're on the website. Membership has some great perks, especially like the new website, which has its own like amazing membership stuff. But now we need to get back to our conversation with Dr. Jeb Card and Maddie Love.
Yes, because Dr. Card promised us right before the break that we were going to talk about Egyptology stuff.
Yes.
And we've already been touching on Cthulhu.
Yes.
And I am extremely interested in hearing more about Egypt and its ties, especially with pop culture and this idea of how old Egypt is.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's a very old idea. And like many things, you can blame the Greeks for it. Because, you know, Egypt is awesome. And I, the more I have worked in, you know, teaching people archaeology and learning about it myself, the more I love it. It was my thing has always been the Maya. Like, that's been my huge, you know, fascination since college. But I've Egypt is awesome sauce. And the Greeks thought so as well. You know, the Greeks, it became a, you know, at one point, like everything awesome and old is from Egypt, almost to the point when like something was a little ridiculous. It might be like, oh, it's from ancient Egypt. You know, it's kind of like, oh, it's from the History Channel. But no, they saw Egypt as the source of ancient wisdom and knowledge. And then they took it over under Alexander and then the Ptolemies, and that did not end. And they adopted a lot of it. And during the Ptolemaic period, while they messed up a lot of understanding of ancient Egypt, it wasn't entirely, you know, they still understood a fair amount. When the Romans take over, that gets worse. And then when the Romans collapse there, then basically a lot of what had come before really starts to recede into ideas of myth and legend. And one of the big parts of this is hieroglyphs. You know, so actual Egyptian hieroglyphs, you know, they mean sacred, you know, in Greek, it literally means sacred signs, sacred symbols. But you know, they could be, in fact, they were often used for what we would consider religion and magic and, you know, help my soul in the duat and, you know, keep protect it and, you know, make this little magical robot work for me in the afterlife because it's got writing on it. But of course, hieroglyphs also record all sorts of things. It's recording human language, although they did infuse like a lot of older societies did a lot, and not so old societies, power in writing. But as time went and that got to be forgotten, a lot of Egyptian things got to be considered, well, this is the beginning. This is ancient. And so that writing must be mythic. It must be bigger than us. It must have more significance. So you had the idea that hieroglyphs were, in essence, kind of a pre, like language kind of communication that was bigger and more spiritual, like tying into things like the Tower of Babel, if there was a language beforehand. You also have the idea that things with hieroglyphs on them and things like the pyramids were left over from before the flood because they're so old and they contain secret magics brought to earth by fallen angels like the Watchers, the Nephilim. That becomes a medieval concept, and that really is a large degree. And if you want to hear more about that, go look at Jason Colavito's blog. He blogs like 5 days a week, massive amount of work, and he really digs into that. I worked with him. We actually basically found, quote unquote, the real Necronomicon. Not actually, but the thing that inspired it to some degree. Okay. Or one of the things that inspired it. Turns out it's an actual Arab medieval book.
As much as I would love to go into the Necronomicon, we actually have another Facebook comment.
Excellent.
From Greg asking the best and worst of the Egyptian / mummy subgenre.
Ah, okay. I mean, I like the 1999, the Rachel Weisz, Brendan Fraser one, I forget the name of the guy who does the mummy. He's actually part of the reason that movie works so well. That's a fun popcorn kind of D&D, fight skeletons, read evil books kind of movie.
I actually like the sequel a little better.
What's that?
I like the sequel better.
The sequel, I don't like it as much, but it's there's just a lot of really junky CGI in it for me. Oh. But it's not bad.
Okay.
The China one doesn't do as well. I like what they tried to do, but it just didn't work.
No.
The 1932, the original Mummy, is also really good. Very different. The plot is basically the same, but it's far less actiony, far more moody. That's excellent. I have had to watch a bunch of the Mummy movies that came after the first 1932 Mummy, and they're just awful. Like, my favorite is they make several that have similar – they're not the same characters from the original Karloff one, but they're the same characters from the sequels, and they're set over, like, 40 years, and they age the actors, but they don't age anything else. So, like, all the material culture, all the stuff is basically, like, 1935 to 1945, but it's, like, 50 years. And you're like, wait, don't – what is happening here?
At least in good sci-fi, they at least try to predict what kind of technology. Oftentimes they're wrong, but then they at least give it a shot.
These were cheap. These were super cheap. These were just like, you know, and like one set in Louisiana, one set in, or I think it is one set in Massachusetts. It's just weird.
So what about,
I saw the Tom Cruise one, the 2017 one.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
It's interesting. It's not good. It's interesting.
You sound very Minnesotan right there.
Yeah.
What about Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy?
I saw one of them as a kid. I've not visited into them. I had limits, and I'm like, I think I can safely leave this one out of the book.
Fair. Do you ever, this is a more serious question, not that the other one wasn't a fantastic question, no, Frank, I'm sorry, but do you ever have students that become interested in archaeology because of their experience of pseudoscience when they're younger?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I've been interested in this kind of stuff from when I was a kid, not so much the pseudo-archaeology or alternative archaeology, but, you know, other kinds of cultic milieu stuff like UFOs and whatnot, very much got me interested in a lot of things. And then, you know, I had to grapple with, wait, there's not... this is nuts. Oh, and then I decide to study it. No, I absolutely do run into people. I run into professionals who also have that kind of in their background. I will say, though, and this is a longer answer I don't think we have time for, I think that has changed because of the nature of both our media and our society and the polarization therein. I think it was a lot easier to start there and end up with real kind of science more than it is now. I think it's a lot easier to just stay there.
And I got to cut you off because that is actually our show for the week. Thank you for tuning in to Atheist Talk. We'd love for you to join us
again
next Sunday. Yes, thank you, Dr. Jeb. Thank you, Maddie Love. Have a great day.